They say that Rome wasn't built in a day, but I wasn't on that particular job. Brian Clough said that. Well, he would, wouldn't he? You know, the football manager, obviously he thought that Rome would have been bigger, better and finished sooner with him at the helm. That's football managers for you, isn't it? They don't change. But in AD 59, when Paul was finally travelling there, it was still pretty impressive, even if Nottingham Forest didn't have a ground there. Well, we're now on the last leg of our journey through the book of Acts of the Apostles. And chapter 28, verse 14, hangs sort of triumphantly over the next couple of weeks, where we read, "And so we came to Rome." That's the goal. That's the destination. Rome was a city that probably as a child, as the son of a Roman citizen, Paul had imagined visiting. It was the hub of an empire that was already 8 centuries old. And from the golden milestone at the Forum, roads led out from Rome to every corner of the empire. People travelled from far and wide to visit this amazing city. It ruled over the known world at the time, which it had linked with its system of roads. You know, we've still got some, haven't we, sort of around here, Roman roads. You know, the A1, you can see where it's a Roman road, dead straight, and there's all sorts, and the Fosse and the Cotswold, loads of them. And it's superb ports. It was a new age of communication. And the Pax Romana kept law and order throughout the empire, and it was overseen by the Roman legions and the Roman navy. And all the glory, really, of the empire was kind of concentrated into Rome itself. There were 3 circuses in the city, not the kind with kind of clowns, clowns and sort of trapeze artists, not those sorts of, the ones where you have the chariot races, where they race wheel to wheel, like in Ben-Hur, those sorts of circuses. So it was very dramatic, very exciting. Still no Nottingham Forest, I know, but you know, there you go. But never mind. But there were the ornate palaces of the Caesars. There were the tombs of the great and the good. There were the temples such as the Pantheon, the basilicas, the theatres, the baths, the aqueducts. It was an amazing place to go. Now, of course, like any great city, it had its dark side. Seneca, the Roman philosopher and statesman, called Rome a cesspool of iniquity. Didn't mince his words, Seneca. And the Roman poet Juvenal, he was equally unimpressed. He called it a filthy sewer. But when all was said and done, this was Rome. Rome. It was like the server at the heart of the internet of its day. If you could successfully connect to Rome, then the world was your oyster. And Paul knew it. And he longed to visit Rome and to preach the gospel there. In the letter to the Romans, chapter 1, he wrote to the Christians who were already established in the city. He said, "I pray that now at last, by God's will, the way may be opened for me to come to you. I long to see you, so that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to make you strong." That is, that you and I may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. But he goes on to say that each time he tried to get to Rome, the way had been blocked. You know, something had happened to stop him from getting there. He'd just not been able to get to Rome. So now, Paul's on his way. He's fulfilling, in a sense, that great commission to take the gospel to the ends of the earth. I mean, it's not fulfilled, it's still ongoing. We're still part of that great commission. But he's kind of doing the next step to get it to the ends of the earth. Because once you get to Rome, if you can then connect there, it will then fan out from the golden milestone and stone in the Forum to the ends of the earth. It is, although, perhaps not quite how Paul had imagined it was going to be. The journey, that is. Because he sets off on his journey under guard. Specifically under the authority of a Roman centurion called Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment, along with some other prisoners. That's how Luke puts it. So Paul is classed as a prisoner under the authority of a Roman centurion. But notice, just as an aside, how verse 2 begins. "We," writes Paul, writes Luke, who's the author of Acts. "We." The narrative moves from third person to first person. Luke is there as well. Luke is embarking on this journey too. He's there with Paul and Aristarchus, a Christian from Thessalonica. And now we're going to join them as well over the next couple of weeks on this great story of shipwrecks and treachery and danger and miracles. And it's all written in great detail. Why does Luke write it in great detail? Well, he's giving us more than a great story. It is a great story, but he's giving us more than a great story. It's more than his attempt at sort of Homer's Odyssey or something like that. See, Luke wants to prove something to us, and he needs to spell it out to us. The situation is this. If you've been reading through Acts, you've seen that time and again, Paul has been on trial. He's been on trial before the religious rulers of the Jewish temple, the Sanhedrin. He's been on trial before the Roman governor. He's been on trial before the king, who's the king of the Jews, the ruler over the Jews, put there by the Roman authorities. So now he's been lumped together with other prisoners. And he's off to Rome to plead his case to Caesar. Was Paul, was he a criminal? Should we listen to Paul? You know, he sounds a bit dodgy, doesn't he? Well, so far, no conviction against him has stood. But is Paul's ultimate fate justified? Spoiler alert, although it's not written down in the book of Acts, Paul is executed in Rome. Well, as we'll see over the next couple of chapters, God has multiple opportunities during this voyage to punish Paul if Paul is an unrighteous, godless sinner and heretic. And that's what Luke's readers would expect if they were reading this. You know, if Paul really wasn't the real deal, God's got plenty of opportunities to finish Paul off before he gets to Rome. But as we go through the next couple of weeks, we'll see that Paul survives every single natural threat. And so let's read those verses as we go through that, understanding that Paul is being acquitted by God here time and again. So, as the soldiers and the prisoners reach the harbour, they encounter their first hurdle. Now, I'm going to just pop a map up. It's actually the map of the whole journey, so it's probably a bit small. But you can sort of see where they start off. They start off at, Caesarea. But the first hurdle is this. There doesn't seem to be a ship sailing directly to Italy. Now, remember, these are ancient times. You couldn't just jump on EasyJet and do a direct flight over to Rome and be there in sort of an hour or two. It was even sort of, you know, very dangerous to do direct sailing journeys over in those days. So perhaps it wasn't seen as such a bad thing to take the more common route of hugging the coastline as long as possible. Now, seeing as Paul has spent the last couple of years in custody at Caesarea, so I'm away from that, I'm not got that on, I don't know if I'm being helpful or not. There we go. Seeing as Paul spent, I'm very loud now. Am I better or worse? Anyway, I'll let David sort it. Seeing as Paul spent the last couple of years in custody at Caesarea, shall I turn that off? Is that a bit crackly? David turned that off. He spent the last couple of years in custody at Caesarea. It's probable that that's the port that Paul is sailing from. And it's just a little quick hop up the coast to Sidon. And there Luke tells us that Julius allows Paul to go to his friends so that they may provide for his needs. See, presumably Paul's still under guard. Julius doesn't go, I'll see you in the morning, Paul, okay? Be a good boy, don't run off, come back, okay? No. So presumably Paul is still under guard. There's still a, you know, centurion or two sent with him. But Paul is allowed to visit his friends for the evening who'll take care of him. And really, Luke is telling us that to emphasise that Paul is different to the other prisoners, to the other charges that Julius has. The other prisoners were probably already condemned for whatever crimes they've been found guilty of. They were probably on their way to face their deaths in the Roman arenas. But Paul is not a convict. He's not been pronounced guilty of any crime. He's a Roman citizen on his way to make his appeal to Caesar. And so the Roman centurion treats him differently. After this little overnight stop, however, the going starts to get tough. They struggle round Cyprus because the winds are against them. But eventually, after their first little, you see that little first stretch of open sea, after they get round Cyprus, they make it to Myra. The winds are against them, but they make it to Myra. And that's as far as their first ship will take them. You know, when you're doing a journey, if you're trying to book on the train line or something, and you're hoping it's going to be one train all the way through, and it's kind of, no, you've got to do a break in your journey and get another connecting train. Okay, that's what they've got to do there. So they've got to find another vessel to continue their journey. And Luke tells us in verse 6, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. But from this point on, the journey becomes increasingly more and more difficult. They make really slow progress. They've got difficulty reaching land. The wind is against them. Luke implies that they have to take an alternate route to the one they'd hoped for, that they'd actually hoped to sort of sail round to the north of Crete. But actually, they have to go round to the south, as you can see the little arrows there on the map showing it. In the end, it sounds like a bit of a relief for the ship to reach the port of Fair Havens. But that said, the relief is short-lived. Now, talking about trains, there's been a lot, hasn't there, on the news about the train delays and the chaos on Network Rail over the last few weeks. And you can imagine, if you'd booked your journey on the train line, and you knew you had to get to a connecting train, and you're waiting for your first train, aren't you? And then it comes up on the board, as you know, it's massively delayed, or it's even been cancelled, and you've got to get the next one. So, you know, you can't do anything about that. You're now delayed, and then by the time you get to that destination, the connecting train that you were hoping for, that's already gone. Well, that's a little bit like the situation that Lucius and his charges find themselves in here. Because the weather has been against them to such an extent, the journey from Sidon has taken so much longer than it should have done. Time has ticked by, and now Luke tells them it was the day after atonement. Well, okay, why is that important? Well, that's a feast day, a celebration day for the Jews, and research has been done. And we can work out, like the way you can do, you know, you can work out Easter and you can go back and work out, well, what Easter was last year and Easter was the year before, and you can work out the dates. You can work out when the Day of Atonement was on different years and go back and back and back and back. And someone who had lots and lots and lots of time, they worked out that back in AD 59, when Paul was on this journey, the Day of Atonement was on October the 5th. Good. But actually that is quite important, because we're not talking, remember, about a lovely great P&O cruise liner here. We're not talking about, you know, the Queen Elizabeth II waiting for its new fancy jets to arrive on it. We're talking about a 2,000 year old sailing vessel. And in those days, the ships stopped sailing in this region by the beginning of November, because it was just too dangerous for them to sail in winter. So if October the 5th has been and gone, the time is really running out and the weather's not looking good. It's like an early winter's kind of starting to set in. It's really not good for a small, vulnerable sailing boat to go much further. Certainly not to be heading out into the open sea. That would be incredibly risky. And here, Paul speaks up. Verse 10. Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo, and to our own lives also. He's very definite about this, isn't he? Has Paul had a direct revelation from God? I don't think so at this point. Because although some of the stuff he says turns out to be true, some of it doesn't. I think he's actually speaking from experience. Again, those with time have calculated that Paul was a veteran of 11 voyages before this one and had clocked up a total of 11,500 miles by sea. That's no small amount these days. It's certainly no small amount 2,000 years ago. In the process, I mean, I know what it's like these days. We holidayed in France last year and we went on a nice big sort of Brittany ferry thing. You see the extent of my nautical knowledge. Poor old Michael's at the back, probably shaking his head. Yeah, but the thing is, you go on one of those, don't you? And quite frankly, you've got very little idea of the workings of it, and you're just on the boat, aren't you? And if it gets a bit rough, you know, you go and watch a film in the cinema or something, and take your mind off it. But that's not the sort of boat that Paul was on. Paul's done 3,500 miles by sea in small vessels. He's picked up in the process a thing or two about sailing in ships, and about the weather, and about navigation, and about all those sorts of important nautical things. He's speaking as an experienced traveller, especially by sea. However, Luke tells us, the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Now, in his defence, you have to kind of, you know, cut a bit of slack for Julius, don't you? Because on the one hand, he's got Paul, preacher and tent maker, on the other hand, he's got the owner of the ship and the pilot. Well, they obviously know a bit more about the ship. Fair enough. Paul gets ignored. Isn't it frustrating when that happens, when you know something and nobody listens to you? That's how it is. You see, the problem is that Fairhaven's is not a great port to winter in. If they stay, there's the real risk of damage being done to the ship. So, Paul's saying, look, that's a risk we ought to take. But the owner and the pilot don't want any damage to happen to their boat. So they're prepared to take the risk to try and get to the port of Phoenix. It's further along Crete. If you have a look at Crete, you can see there's Phoenix. Now, you can see what happens next week. Bit of a giveaway. They don't quite make it. But anyway, we'll move away from that so you don't start looking at next week's journey. We're going to pick up the story again next week. But the thing is, that's what they decide to do. They decide to head for the port of Phoenix because they think it's a much safer place to sit out the stormy season. We'll pick it up next week, as I say. But what can we take away from today's passage? I mean, at first glance, it just looks a bit like a sort of travel diary, doesn't it? But 2 Timothy 3:16 tells us, all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching, rebuking, correcting and training in righteousness. So what does this passage teach us? Well, the thing is, Paul has been longing to go to Rome, hasn't he? And proclaim the gospel there. He's tried in the past, again and again and again, to get to the heart of the empire, but each time he's been prevented. Then, in Acts 23, verse 11, we read that the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." It looks like it's green light for go. There's the Canadian Grand Prix on today. I quite like the Grand Prix. And Murray Walker doesn't do it anymore. But they've got a new guy. But he's got his own little catchphrase now, which is when they start. Because what happens at the start is 5 red lights go on, one by one. And then all the red lights go off together and they set off. And his little catchphrase is, "It's lights out, away we go!" And that's kind of how Paul probably felt after Jesus came and said this to him. It's lights out, away we go to Rome. But Paul is wise about God's timing. He can see that even when God says, "Look, this is the door that I'm going to open for you," it doesn't always mean right this second, right now. Although Paul knew, although he absolutely knew that Jesus was sending him to Rome, he could also weigh up their journey with his practical experience of sailing and weather conditions ahead, as well as what had delayed them so far. And unlike the owner and the pilot of the ship, he could see that it was wise to wait. God gives us a brain to be able to work things out and use our experience and use our knowledge to trust in him, but not to just rush in blindly. Often we can sense that God is calling us to something individually or as a family or as a church. And if he is, then it's right for us to move on that. Not to do a Jonah, not to run in the opposite direction. But it's also right to move in God's time. God won't move you too fast. He won't, if you like, drown you in the process of getting you to Rome. God gives us wisdom and experience to use when he's calling us into his service. So when we sense God calling us to do something, we need to employ the good sense that he's given to us as well, to discern exactly how and when that will work out. An example that I can give you from my own personal life is when I was seeking ordination or questioning whether God was calling me to ordination. It was 9 whole years from the first point when I first thought, oh, maybe this is what God's calling me to. 9 years of exploring and meeting with people and praying and pushing doors and not always getting an open one and inquiring and seeking. 9 years from that first thought to being ordained. It would have been wrong to rush and go straight in. You know, but it was always moving forward, always pushing the next door, not trying to run ahead of God's plan for me. And that's how it can be for us as individuals, as families, as a church. Sometimes God will want us as a church or family, as an individual, if I can say it properly, to do something now. It won't always be wait. Sometimes it will be now that he wants us to do something and not to put it off. Not to tie it up in excuses and endless meetings and subcommittees. But sometimes we need to be ready to let things happen more slowly. The Bible is littered with individuals. Abraham and Jacob and even Judas, who knew God's promises, but who tried to force God's hand. And it never ends well for them. God's plans are not thwarted, but it makes it so much difficult for his people in the process. So the thing is, do we have the patience to obey God according to his timescale? Are we ready sometimes just to say, okay, that's where we're going, but not quite yet? It's not an excuse to sit back and do nothing as Christian individuals or families or churches, but rather it reminds us that God calls us to submit to his will. After all, that's what we pray, isn't it, in the Lord's Prayer? Thy will be done. But in the process of obeying God's will, not to run ahead of him as we do it. Why not? Oh, well, that's next week's talk. Amen.